I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Zora Neale Hurston's book, Barracoon, The Story of the Last Black Cargo, was written almost 90 years ago and has just been published by Amistad, an imprint of HarperCollins. It's based on a series of interviews Hurston conducted with Oluwole Kosola, thought to be the last survivor of the last slave ship, Clotilda. Hurston Tate Kosola and his first-person account of being kidnapped, forced into slavery, and living long enough to see freedom is moving and painful, tragic, heroic, and deeply unsettling. Hurston refused to edit Kosola's dialect, and Viking decided not to publish the book back in the 1930s, so it has languished, largely forgotten, until now. Today on Radio Times, the story of Barracoon and what it tells us about Hurston Kosola, slavery, our heritage, and history. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Deborah Plant is the editor of Barracoon, and she's an African-American literature and African studies scholar and literary critic. Deborah Plant, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Autumn Womack is with us as well, and she's an assistant professor of African-American studies and English at Princeton University. She specializes in 19th and 20th century, early 20th century, I should say, African-American literary and visual cultures. Autumn Womack, nice to have you with us on Radio Times
as
well.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And I should say we're going to hear during this hour some readings by Johnny Hobbs Jr. He's a professional actor and educator based here in Philadelphia, and we asked him to read portions of the book where we hear Kosola's voice. Deborah, let me begin with you. It's been almost 90 years since this book was first written. Is the time right for its publication, even though it's been, if not buried, but certainly away from mass public viewing? Is the time right for this book?
I would say the time is perfect for it. Yes, the manuscript was completed, a final draft of it in 1931, and of course, before that, we have the biography of Oluwole Kosola, who was born around 1841. So that's a while, but it's still relevant. You know, when we look at what is going on today, when we look at the issues we're faced today around the globe and right here in America, this is the perfect time. Questions of freedom, questions of inclusion, who belongs here, who doesn't belong here, and under what conditions, these are all questions that we still have, and these are insights that we can look at in terms of how we might address what's going on today when we look at Kosola's narrative. So it's the perfect time. This book enters a conversation that has been going on, and we can look at currently the conversation that Barracoon joins. And when I say that, I'm talking about Toni Morrison's Origin of Others. I'm talking about Colson Whitehead's Underground Railroad, Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me. We look at Ava DuVernay's 13th, which refers to the 13th Amendment. And we look at the work of Bryan Stevenson and his statement that the 13th Amendment did not end slavery. Basically, slavery continues in other ways, and we can look at the jail industrial complex and all of these issues that, for every issue that we see in Barracoon, we see it today.
Well, let me turn to you, Autumn. How do you see this book and see this narrative and the voice of Oluwole?
Like Deborah, I see this narrative really resonating with things that are happening today and really resonating with, I think, the general public's desire to have a more complex and robust understanding of slavery and all of the ways that it reverberates and resonates in our contemporary moment. I think one of the things that's so striking about Barracoon is that as much as people kind of expect it to be a slave narrative, the chapter on slavery is really short.
I was going to raise that.
It's like the shortest chapter in the book. It's maybe 4 or 5 pages. And what we actually get is this rollout of all of the ways that both his life on the other side of slavery and then his on both sides of slavery, I should say, really kind of draw out all of the implications of what it means to be forcefully brought to this country and all of the different ways that oppression and slavery kind of reverberates and resonates through his life.
Well, I do want to play a clip of Johnny Hobbs Jr. reading from this book. Let me just put to you, Deborah, before we hear that, a little bit about the controversy about the language. Mm-hmm. And perhaps one of the reasons if Viking didn't publish it in the 1930s, Zora Neale Hurston was told to, in a sense, anglicize the language, mm-hmm. something she did not do. Why did she want to keep the words as they were?
Zora Neale Hurston, in addition to being the brilliant novelist that we know, and most of us know her in relation to Their Eyes Were Watching God, she was also a genius and pioneering social scientist. So as a cultural anthropologist who also was an ethnographer and folklorist, Hurston understands, you know, the significance of language. And to give us Kosala's narrative and to give it to us in the language that he speaks, in the vernacular that he speaks, in the idiom, in the dialect, then she's giving us more than just a story. She's giving us insight into a life and into a history. And so an ethnographer knows that language is an authenticating feature of any kind of portrait you're trying to create of a person or a people. And so this is not something Hurston would compromise on. And, you know, we could talk long about that, but suffice it to say that to change the language, to write it in what is called so-called standard English, or what I call the language of the establishment, is to basically perpetrate another kind of erasure. Embedded in the language is everything about his history, his deracination, the violence that he experienced, and also the resistance mm-hmm. to this attempt to dehumanize and subjugate. And, you know, these are very important issues. And I think another very important issue we don't think about so much is the fact that this was not his mother tongue. Okay. He was born in Bante, West Africa. He was speaking some version of Yoruba. He was not speaking a vernacular. All right. So how does a man come from 19 years of, you know, living in his own homeland to a point in Alabama where he's speaking a vernacular, what we call Atlantic Creole? There's embedded in that language is all of that history. To change that would be basically to erase him.
Well, and I think when people listen through the hour as Johnny Hobbs Jr. reads some of what Kosala says, they will hear the beauty, even the poetry in some of the language that he uses. She says, you know, I want to know who you are and how you came to be a slave. Those were the questions that really Zora Neale Hurston wanted to understand as she interviewed a man. And we're going to listen to a section where Cujo talks about his name.
My name is not Cujo Lewis. It's Kazula. When I get in American soil, Mr. Jim Mayer, he tried to call me my name, but it's too long. You understand me? So I say, well, are your property? He say, yeah. Then I say, you calling me Cujo, that do. But in Africa soil, my mama, she named me Kazula.
Autumn names are just so important. I mean, not just to identity, but just the deepness of identity.
Yeah, the name, I think, is, for him, getting the name right. I mean, it's always been a part of the African-American slave narrative tradition, right? Being able to name oneself or to claim the name or to remember the name, right, has been a way of reclaiming identity and asserting identity. So I think for Kosala in this moment to say, you know, they couldn't get my name right, but this is my name, right? And I'm going to tell you, Hurston, and I trust you, right, that you are going to record it right and that you are going to convey it in the way that is true to how I'm saying it, right, or to kind of the most accurate representation. I think at this moment, right, we hear the relationship between him and Hurston, right? As much as we hear kind of this history of attempted erasure and then reclamation on his part.
And we should add that this slave ship, Clotilda's, the slave trade, if we can call it that, was illegal at the time that Caussola was kidnapped and taken to the United States.
Right, absolutely. So the slave trade was allegedly illegal, as we know. It went on and on and on. So one of the things that I think is really poignant in the text is that we see all of these undercover practices, right, of really smuggling these bodies right into the U.S. And it raises an entire set of questions about a different kind of confusion that was going on the part of the captives, right? It's the middle of the night. Where are you taking us? What is happening? This isn't supposed to be happening. So it just, it textures this narrative that we think we have such a handle on.
Well, human trafficking, that's what we're talking about, is it not,
right,
Deborah?
Exactly.
Plant?
Well, that's exactly what it was, trafficking. And you know, we can sort of, I don't know, pretend morality in relation to some parts of it being legal, some being illegal. It's all wrong. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, 1807, you know, the Constitution states that trafficking across the Atlantic is no longer allowed. It's abolished. And it was to go into effect in 1808. And the penalty for trafficking was initially you'll be seen as a pirate. This is considered piracy. And initially there are fees levied against those who commit piracy. And because it kept going anyway, despite the abolition of trafficking, transoceanic trafficking, then the penalties increase, and to the point of hanging being the ultimate penalty for piracy. But, you know, we're looking at over 50 years of this so-called illegal trafficking, illegal trade, and only one person was hanged for this whole period of time. You know, hundreds of Africans were uprooted and brought to America. Hundreds, thousands. And only one person, and he died saying he was innocent. And I think that says a whole lot about what Autumn refers to as, you know, the shadowy kind of underculture that's going on. That basically, you know, when you look at people like Timothy Mayer and William Foster, it was their birthright.
Right.
And Foster was the captain of the ship,
Mayer
was the...
Right. The idea that you have the right as a man and as a white man to not only defy the law, but also you know that you have such a status in society that you'll get away with it.
Hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a very short break. That's Deborah Plant. Also with us, Autumn Womack. We are talking about Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo, written almost 90 years ago. Zora Neale Hurston. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Let me just recap what we're talking about. Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo by Zora Neale Hurston, was written back in the 1930s, but considered too incendiary to publish. It's based on interviews that she did with Awale Kosala, the last survivor of the last slave ship. The book has now been published, and it's called Barracoon. And our guests are Deborah Plant. She's the book's editor and African-American literature scholar. Autumn Womack with us as well, assistant professor of African-American Studies and English at Princeton University. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play another reading that Johnny Hobbs Jr. did for us. Again, he's a professional actor, educator based here in Philadelphia, and he is reading the portions of the book where we hear Awale Kosala talking about his life. And this is when he's in his country called Dahomey, and he is being captured. Let's give it a listen.
When I see the king dead, I try to escape from the soldiers. I try to make it to the bush but all the soldiers overtake me before I get there. Oh, Lord, when I think about that time, I try not to cry no more. My eyes, they stop crying, but the tears running down inside me all the time. When the men pull me with them, I call my mama name. I don't know where she is. I don't see none of my family. I don't know where they is. I begged the men to let me go finding my folks. The soldiers, they got no ears for crying. The king of Dahomey come to hunt slaves to sell. So they tie me with the rest in line. The sun is just rising. All day they make us walk. The sun so hot. The king of Dahomey, he ride the hammock, and the chiefs with him, they got hammock too. Poor me, I walk. The men at Dahomey tie us in the line so nobody run off. In their hand, they got the head of people that they kill in Tocoi. Some got 2-3 head they carry with them to Dahomey. I so sad for my home, I ain't getting hungry that day. But I glad when we drink the water.
And again, Johnny Hobbs Jr. reading from Barracoon, such a heartbreaking description of what happened to him in Dahomey. Can you speak, Autumn, a bit about, and what we hear here is that there, yes, the soldiers come to get Kosala and others. They're put in a chain, roped together, mm-hmm. and taken to the slave ship. But we hear about the king of Dahomey and his implication.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what's so powerful about this passage is that we hear and we read about the complex workings of the African slave trade, right? And what always strikes me is that we get a much more expansive geography. So this isn't just happening right on the very coast, right? Which is how we often think of the slave castles and the door of no return, right? But this is far inland, right? And he recounts the days and days and days that it took them to get to the coast. And it also really variegates this idea or this myth we have of a unified Africa, right? I mean, these were different cultures. These were different states. These were different governments. These were different rulers, different ways of living and being. And they saw each other as adversaries, right? So it wasn't out of the ordinary to go to war and take captors and sell them into slavery. So it shows, right, that all of the different workings, right, and really the expansive economy of the transatlantic slave trade, right? It wasn't just white captors and black slaves, right? I mean, this was an international slave trade that stretched far into Africa, mm-hmm. far into Europe, all throughout North America, right, even down to South America. We know this in the Caribbean. So it expands the geography and the economy.
And Deborah, this is Benin, as we understand, or as you understand it, we're talking about the country of Benin as it is today. I mean, this is when he refers to Dahomey.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
What do you hear in this? So painful.
Also what Autumn has described. And just to expand on that, you know, the traffic, we talk about the transatlantic traffic, but that was traffic all around the coast of Africa, not just on the West Coast, whether it's across the Red Sea or the Mediterranean. It further east. All of these are points of disembarkation or points where Africans were taken and driven into other lands. And it is very complex. And, as Autumn pointed out, it's like you had this not only diversity on the African continent, but you had, you know, hostilities. You had bellicose nations and more peaceful nations like that which, Kosala came from. And the other side of that is, you know, we look at that and say, well, Africans, quote unquote, Africans fought each other. Well, Europeans were doing the same thing. When you look at, you know, say you go to Senegal and you go to Gorée Island and you look at the cannons that are lined, you know, at the fort, they're pointing outward and not inward. They're pointing outward toward other European or English countries that at one time or another try to take over, you know, those particular places. And, you know, from one decade to the next, 1 year to the next, there's the English, there are the Portuguese, there are the French, there are the Dutch, and they're fighting each other too. So it's, you know, it's all mayhem. And what I would like to, what I hear in that is what Donna Richards calls this the Maiafa, this uprooting. And we don't get the trauma of this until we read something, hear something like what Kosla describes, the horror of this. And, you know, this is when you have been so radically uprooted from everything you know, your mother tongue, your motherland, your very mother, and you know, and everything that means anything to you, the whole meaning, your worldview, you're uprooted from that. That's such a trauma that we don't understand the reverberations of that. That this is intergenerational, and we wonder, you know, like what's wrong, and we keep asking the question, you know, who am I, where do I belong, because that taking from where we were and where we belong was so horrific, and it's always still tested, like even today, where do we belong and are we safe here, and you know, are we still in a hostile environment, or can we finally call someplace home?
Let me play another reading from Barracoon, and again, Johnny Hobbs Jr. Reading, and this is Kosla on the slave ship describing what it was like. Let's give it a listen.
Soon we get in the ship. They make us lay down in the dark. We stay there 13 days. They don't give us much to eat. Me so thirst. They give us a little bit of water twice a day. Oh, Lord, Lord, we so thirst. The water tastes sour. On the 13th day, they fetch us up on the deck. We so weak, we ain't able to walk ourselves, so the crew take each one and walk around the deck till we get so we can walk ourselves. We looky and looky, we don't see nothing but water. Where we come from, we don't know. Where we going, we don't know. The boat we own, called Catilda, Cujo suffer so in that ship. Oh, Lord, I so scared of the sea. The water, you understand me? It making me so much noise. It growl like a thousand beasts in the bush. The wind got so much voice in the water. Oh, Lord. Sometimes the ship way up in the sky. Sometimes it way down in the bottom of the sea. They say the sea was calm. Cujo don't know. Seem like it move all the time. One day, the color of the water change, and we see some islands. But we don't come to that shore for 70 days.
And again, a reading from Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo, the story of Owale Kosla, who, when he was enslaved in America, was called Cujo Lewis. What we hear, Autumn, in this is, you know, where we come from, we don't know. Where we're going, we don't know. And Deborah was talking about just the trauma of being ripped from your family, your country, and sent to a place you have no idea where.
Right.
Where are you going?
Right. And one of the things that, just listening to it again, this this moment. We hear this, not only confusion, but also just how everything was just so new, right? And in turn, really terrifying. So something like the ocean, right? That moment where he says it sounded like the animal, the beast growling in the bush, right? And a little bit earlier in the book, we have he's being kind of going through this rite of passage, and he hears these, what he thinks are beasts growling in the bush. So there's this echoing of that moment in the text where he actually now is faced with this unknown, this real unknown. You know, hearing it again, I also think we get the repetition, right? The ocean, we're so thirsty, we're so thirsty, we're so thirsty. And this goes back to what Deborah was saying about the importance of keeping the speech as accurate as possible, because I think what we hear is that fear and that anxiety, right? And the repetition of the phrases and him recalling that. He didn't know where he was going. He didn't know what the ocean was. He didn't know who these people were. Then what we get in the second, or I should say the second half of the book, is him trying to make sense of it all, right? How do you build a life in a space that is not your home and when you're faced with the reality that you're not going back, right?
Deborah, let's talk a little bit about the relationship between Oluwale Kosola Cudjo-Lewis and Zora Neale Hurston. She interviews him a number of times, goes down to where he's living. This is in the late 1920s. And I said to you before going on the air, as an interviewer, I was interested in how she approached the person that she was talking to. And obviously, this was not in a studio setting, but really where he was living. And it's unclear to me, does he want to talk to her? How much does she have to convince him to talk to her? He was well known at the time among anthropologists and others who were trying to understand how someone could survive slavery. Mm-hmm. But how did you see their relationship?
It was.
And she brought him a lot of food, I should say, which I have nothing here for anybody, ever.
Right. Well, you know, food and drink, that's the currency of relationship and conversation and what have you. And you're in the South. I mean, you know, that's very important. You offer people something. You come with something, right? So that's tradition. And it speaks to that kind of what would I call it? This way of interrelating with people, that you recognize the humanity by do you want a cool drink of water, or you know, are you hungry? Mm-hmm. And you offer, you know, this is how you build communion. As well as community. And so for Hurston, first of all, she has respect for African-American peoples. You know, he's a human being. He's not just an informant. He's not just someone to go and collect a story from. She's relating to him on a human level. And as a social scientist, also, she's learning from him. He's really teaching her how to do this interview, all right? Because when she goes initially, she wants him to, Kosola, tell me about you.
Right.
He wants to tell her about his grandfather.
That's right. In fact, a lot of the book is really about his family, his grandfather.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you know, she says, you know, she writes, I was afraid he would go off on a tangent, but I wanted to know about him. And she says this, and he stops her. He says, where is the house where the mouse is the ruler? And then she sort of chilled out. And, you know, she slowed her roll. Right? Because, you know, you could tell he wasn't going to change how he tells a story. And that has everything to do with his worldview,
sure.
With what's important. The ancestors are important. You know, your elders are important. And you give them that due respect. And she had to respect that in order to get to his particular story. So there is that. And then there's just the patience. The patience, the persistence, the ability to not take personally his sort of gruff behavior sometimes.
Sometimes he didn't want to talk to her.
Right, because sometimes he didn't. Right. And, you know, she was there, Yeah, he was a celebrity, and he had been interviewed other times, but not as consistently as what Hurston was doing. Hurston interviewed him enough times to have his story, which, you know, constitutes a book. That's not what others were doing, right? So this is a prolonged kind of thing that's going on. And so to sweeten it, so to speak, she's patient, and she comes bearing gifts. And not only that, and she says so herself, these are traumatic events in his life. He's so full of grief. You know, sometimes she's talking to him and he's answering, and then he stops and he's just staring into the abyss of the past. And all she can do is respect that and leave, you know. So there's respecting the rhythm of his ability to tell the story, because sometimes he just doesn't have the words, and the only thing that's there is the pain.
Well, and I think we're reading the finished product. The pain is there, but to be able to speak about it with the kind of eloquence that he does, really, it seems to me, requires a lot of forbearance on his part.
Absolutely.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Deborah Plant, and she's the editor of Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo, written by Zora Neale Hurston almost 90 years ago, and it has just been published. Autumn Womack is with us as well, and she's an assistant professor of African-American studies and English at Princeton University, and she specializes in 19th and early 20th century African-American literary and visual cultures. And again, Johnny Hobbs Jr., professional actor and educator based here in Philadelphia, has been reading portions from Barracoon so that we can hear the voice of Oluwale Kosola, or Cujo Lewis, as he was called as an enslaved person, to give us a feel for who this person was. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the story of Barracoon, what it tells us about Nora Zeale Hurston, Oluwale Kosola, slavery, our heritage and history. And again, our guests are joining us here in our Philadelphia studio, Autumn Womack and Deborah Plant. Autumn, there was some controversy while Zora Neale Hurston was interviewing Oluwale Kosola, she was down there several times to talk to him, but early on she did publish something. What was the controversy about?
Right. So the trip that resulted in Barracoon was actually her second trip down to see Lewis, second trip that we know of. So she went earlier in 1927, I believe, and she was sent down there to collect his story by Carter G. Woodson, and this was supposed to be published in the Journal of Negro History. So she went down there, and she did interview him. She spent some time with him. What actually happened or transpired in the interview, we don't know, but we can guess that it wasn't so productive, because she did end up publishing a version in the Journal of Negro History that was highly, highly, highly plagiarized. Mm. And the plagiarism wasn't discovered during her lifetime. So then when she went back down again to visit him, and she left in December 1927, her goal was, we can imagine, doing it right this time, right? Getting it right. And part of the reason it's speculated that she didn't ever come forward about the plagiarism is that she was embarrassed. Uh-huh. And she really wanted to get it right this time. So we have her going back down there to visit him, producing Barracoon, but then also playing with different ways to tell this story over the course of her life, which I think is a fascinating way to situate this text in relationship to all these
It shows up in her other works.
It shows up in her other works. So she mentions him in her own autobiographies, but she also did a film of him, right? She played around with the idea of including a list of his parables in some of her other published works. So she was really fascinated with him, and also really struggled with, how do you tell this story, right? What is the form that can best communicate this incredible story of survival, really?
Well, let me go back to one more reading. Johnny Hobbs Jr., again reading from Barracoon, and this is where he's come to America. They're two brothers. One is Jim and Tim, and he talks about how he and some of the other enslaved people are treated. Let's give it a listen.
Captain Tim and Captain Burns may have worked their folks hard. They got overseer with the whip. One man tried a whippy on my countrywoman, and they all jump on him and take the whip away from him and lash him with it. He don't never try to whip African women no more. They work very hard for us to do, because we ain't used to working like that. But we don't grieve about that. We cry because we slave. In nighttime, we cry. We say we born, raised to be free people, and now we slave. We don't know why we be bring way from our country to work like this. It's strange to us. Everybody look at us strange. We want to talk with the other colored folks, but they don't know what we say. Some making fun of us. Captain Jim, he a good man. He not like his brother, Captain Tim. He don't want his folks knock and beat all the time. He see my shoes get raggedy, you know, and he say, Cujo, if that be the best shoes you got, I got to give you some more. That's right. I tell him no lies. He work us hard, you understand me? But he don't work at his folks like his brother. They got two plantation, one on the Kennesaw River and one on the Alabama River.
And again, Johnny Hobbs Jr. reading from Barracoon. Deborah, let me go back to you. And Autumn mentioned this earlier. He spent 5.5 years as an enslaved person working for Captain Jim, as he calls him. But we don't know much about what those 5 years were about. Was it that Hurston didn't ask him? He didn't tell? Do we know?
Yes, she did, and yes, we do. But before I get to that, I have to say something. And, you know, with all due respect to my esteemed colleague and to those scholars that I know she's drawing from, Hurston was not a plagiarist. Okay? The initial article that was published, Hurston didn't publish, Carter G. Woodson published it. Hurston went down to Alabama to collect Khosla's story about being captured. And she did go into the archives in Alabama and drew from that to put into what was basically a report. It's not different from the other reports that she had collected in the field at the same time. There's another one published in the same journal called Communications. It's a strung together listing of different data sets that she put together for Carter G. Woodson. She gave that to Carter G. Woodson. Carter G. Woodson published it. So is this something she intended to do? I don't think so. Hmm. And over and above that, Hurston knows how to get a story from somebody. I don't think she has an issue with how to get a story. She had been doing it, you know, the whole time. And, you know, this is also the period where she gives us the information that's in Mews and Men. Hurston knows how to collect a story, and she doesn't need to borrow from anyone, especially, you know, given some of the kinds of attitudes that Emma Langdon Roche interwove into her account of things. That says something else that has nothing to do with what Hurston would want to borrow from. Why would she? So I'll leave that
Fair
at
enough.
That.
Fair enough.
Okay. So, with his time in servitude, they do talk about it, and it's not you know, extended as such, but he talks about working on the steamboats and how, and he, there's a part where he names all of the stops that the boat makes, right? And he talks about being forced to work hard, and if you don't work hard, then there's some overseer who's, you know, going to beat you, and, you know, you have to almost run to get things done and to keep up and go as fast and quickly as they want you to do. So, and because it's on the steamboat, this is where the Union soldiers find him later, right? So they do talk about that.
Fair enough. Let me play one more clip, and again, this is Johnny Hobbs Jr. reading from Barracoon, and this is when Kosala learns that he and other enslaved people are free. And I just want to play that one more reading, and then I'm going to toss this back to you, Autumn. Let's listen.
The Yankee soldiers, they come down to the boat and eat the mulberries off the tree close to the boat. You understand me? Then they see us on the boat and they say, y'all can't stay here no more. You're free. You don't belong to nobody no more. Oh, Lord, I'm so glad. We ask the soldiers, where we going? They say, they don't know. They told us we can go where we feel like going. We ain't no more slave.
So Autumn, he learns he's no more a slave. I mean, it's the band isn't playing, you know, it's right. Just this tiny moment where he learns he is no longer an enslaved person.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what's really striking about that moment is we get this other narrative of emancipation that's not about this grand narrative, right, at all. In fact, it's what scholars call kind of this non-event of emancipation, right? And what rolls out after it is him living through Reconstruction, the failure of Reconstruction, the turn of the 20th century, the Great Depression, all of these things. And it rolls out as a series of disappointments, if nothing else. Right? He tries to buy land, and he's not able to buy land. He tries to make appeals to the law, right? And he's shut down in the court of law. So it's the kind of the non-event of this grand emancipatory thing, right, then reverberates into all of these other slow kind of violences, slow disappointments that he experiences.
Right. And he lives in a place he calls it's called Africa Town. And I guess this is where other people on that same slave ship live together. What do we know about Africa Town?
Oh, see, yeah, this is it's very eventful because when they learn that they are free, the first thing they want to do is go home.
Yeah.
They want to go back to whence they came. Then they learn that they can't. It's too expensive. And then the next thing they want is some land. And they approach Timothy Mayer, you know. It's like, you took us from our home where we had land. You bring us here, you make us free, but we don't have our land. And we don't have anything. And why don't you give us a piece of this land? Of course, Timothy Mayer, you know, he's up in arms about that. They decide, well, since reparations, you know, won't be granted, we will just work for this land. And so they did. They worked. They pooled their money. They bought parcels and acres, and they combined it. And that land is the foundation of Africa Town. These people, uprooted from the place that was home, could not return to Africa. So their impetus was, let us recreate Africa here. And that's what Africa Town is about. So it's a community. It's not a town. It could have been because they established all of the, you know, those kinds of aspects of a town. They had their church, they had schools, you know, all of these institutions, but they didn't incorporate. But they maintained their community autonomously, and that community is still there and is still thriving. Mm-hmm. And it's in what's called Plateau, Alabama, but Africa Town is there. And you know, it speaks to so much about African ingenuity and the desire to be in Africa, in Alabama.
Let me raise another person, and this is Charlotte Mason. And Autumn, let me go back to you. And I have to say that Zora Neale Hurston dedicates Barracoon to Charlotte Mason, my godmother, and the one mother of all the primitive who, with the gods in space, is concerned about the hearts of the untaught. What do we need to know about Charlotte Mason?
Yeah, so Charlotte Mason is a fascinating If not highly problematic,
yes.
figure in the Harlem Renaissance and kind of in this what we think of now as the New Negro Movement. So she was Hurston's benefactress, essentially. And she paid Hurston. She gave her a stipend. And they also had an agreement, and she made many of her clients is not the right words, but people like Hurston, right, who she was invested in. She made them sign contracts, right, saying that everything that you collect, I have ownership over. So when she sent Hurston on this, what she called a, as Good Mason called it, kind of this fact-finding mission, she sent her down south and said, I want you to collect everything you can, essentially, about Black folk life. And the agreement was that Hurston would send it all back to Mason. So Mason was, I mean, what we think of or what we call now as a primitivist, right? She was obsessed with collecting both African culture and African-American culture. And I think the tension that we often see with Hurston and Mason is that Hurston didn't always think of it as something that could be collected, right? I mean, she often said Black folk culture is still alive. It's in the making. It's ongoing. So there's always this tension between the two of them, right? How do I give her these artifacts that she wants when I'm also seeing Black folk culture as alive? But they also had a really, in their letters, it appears as very loving, right? So that's the curious part.
It's the language that they use.
The language she writes, they write to each other with a lot of adoration. She also had a relationship with Langston Hughes and Miguel Covarrubias, right? So she supported all of these important Black artists. So it's hard to parse out, right? As it often is with Hurston, hard to parse out what she's being serious about and how much she's playing into Mason's desires in order to kind of get what both Hurston needs and appease Mason. But then at the very same time in the introduction, she says, this is not an object of scientific inquiry, right? So I'm not actually giving her the thing that she wants. I'm producing this other thing, which I think also gets back to this tension about the plagiarism, right? So she's going down the first time equipped with this set of social scientific tools and apparatus that she's given to by Franz Boas and all of her mentors and her trainers who are training her in this early social science. And perhaps she couldn't get what she wanted with those tools that she was using. So she goes back down a second time and, you know, has a different approach that isn't as social scientific. But so I think that there is something about this tenuous relationship that they had.
We have only 30 seconds before we have to end the show. I'm sorry about that, Deborah Plant. But what do you want people to take from Barracoon? And I'm sorry to give you only 30 seconds to answer that. Not fair.
I would say what we see in Kosala is, you know, a human being who is so deeply, what would I say, resonant in terms of his spirituality, in terms of his personality, who he is. And he tells us, his story is so much about who we are. I would say, you know, let us see him as a mirror of our own self and what's possible for us. Because he touches us deeply where our humanity exists.
Perfect way to end the hour. Thank you so much, Deborah Plant, for coming in.
You're welcome.
And she's the editor of Barracoon, also African-American literature, African studies scholar, and literary critic. Autumn Womack, thank you for joining
thank
us as
you.
Well. And she is an assistant professor of African-American studies and English at Princeton University. And a special thanks to Johnny Hobbs, Jr., professional actor and educator based here in Philadelphia. And he read sections from Barracoon. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.